Today, the writing on the wall. The DFA Daily for the 17th of May, 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. That phrase is based on the story of Belshazzar's feast in the Book of Daniel, or it's known as the story of the as illustrated by this Rembrandt master. Belshazzar holds a great feast and drinks from the vessels that had been looted in the destruction of the first temple. A hand appears and writes on the wall. The terrified Belshazzar calls for his wise men, but they are unable to read the writing. The queen advises him to send for Daniel, renowned for his wisdom. Daniel then reads the message and interprets it. So the writing on the wall is an idiomatic expression that suggests a portent of doom or misfortune. And I feel a bit the same just now with all the information coming through, and it's there for those who want to see it, but of course many can't or won't. And before we start, a quick reminder, I'll be running my next finance and property live stream on Tuesday the 19th of May at 8 p.m. Sydney time, the day the RBA minutes are out. I'll be discussing the latest writing on the wall and update my finance and property scenarios. And as usual, you can ask a question in real time via the chat on YouTube or send a question in ahead of time via the DFA blog. And I need your help. Cookie Boy, one of my enthusiastic followers, has challenged me to get more than 1,000 on the live stream. Last time we had over 900, so please spread the word about the live show. Cookie Boy will donate $400 to a charity of my choice if we can achieve that milestone. Now, I can't do that alone, but with your help, we certainly can. Now, talking about writing on the wall, the panic created by COVID-19 has caused a huge amount of financial stress among Australians, with 77% saying that they feel that way. Nearly a quarter, 24%, said that they were feeling extremely stressed about their finances, according to the JD Power Banking Industry Insight Survey. The survey, which involved more than 1,400 Australians and was conducted between April 28th and May the 13th, said the short and long-term effects of the pandemic on individual finances is becoming a significant concern for many Australians. According to the results, 72% of respondents said the coronavirus crisis has negatively impacted their finances. Other key findings include that 39% are feeling worried or anxious often, 37% are losing sleep, 10% are unable to afford enough for food to eat. Of concern is that 35% of respondents said they don't even think the worst is over, an outlook shared by Canadians at 41% and Americans at 42%. Only one-fifth or 17% of respondents said the worst is behind us, 27% said the worst is right now, and 35% said the worst is yet to come, while 12% said COVID-19 will not affect their finances at all. The majority of households are struggling with their debts, as only 38% have reported a manageable amount of debt or no debt. And since the pandemic began, nearly 1 in 5 or 19% of respondents said they can't meet their minimum monthly credit card repayments, while another 11% can't make both personal loan repayments and mortgage repayments. Payment deferrals are in demand in the JD Power survey, showing 15% of respondents said they would like to receive information from their bank on loan payment deferrals, while 24% would like to defer monthly service fees and 16% would request to defer credit card payments. And over a quarter, 26% of Australians, are using their credit card more for household necessities, while 42% of cardholders say they are spending less on their card. 22% are using their card more often to pay household bills. And a number of banks have introduced relief for credit card customers in response to COVID-19. For example, Westpac introduced credit card interest payment holidays, CommBank is offering interest refunds for home loans and credit card customers, and NAB has slashed credit card rates and fees and has reduced minimum repayment requirements. And our data from our surveys is also showing a rise in the use of short-term or payday loans and, by now, pay-later solutions like Afterpay. And banks have deferred the repayments of 1 in 14 mortgages, totaling more than $150 billion, to assist Australians through the pandemic. The Australian Banking Association released new figures which showed 429,000 mortgages have been deferred, totaling $153.5 billion. The figures take the total number of loans deferred to 703,000, worth more than $211 billion. And banks have also hired 1,500 new staff and redeployed over 2,200 staff to frontline areas such as call centres to help meet the surge in demand for support over the last few months. And lobby groups of all flavours are all very exercised at the moment. Here are a couple of classics. Property Council of Australia Chief Executive Ken Morrison told The Australian that student accommodation underpins several markets and the wider sector would not recover in the near term without an influx of migrants. There is no reason why we couldn't transition, depending on the health advice, towards a resumption in net overseas migration and a resumption in offshore student visas. You have student accommodation, which is directly reliant on offshore student visas, and then often the families will buy a unit or an apartment here for the student. That leads to other investments in property. A transition back to normal migration growth that's safe for Australians will be key. It will be very hard to recover in the near term without it. And Master Builders Australia Chief Executive Danita Wan said any extended slowdown in population growth into next year would ultimately harm both residential and commercial builds. I don't think a lot of people realise the problem short-term and long-term population changes can cause. If your population stays static, you will see a significant downturn in building and construction, and that will cost jobs. But here we go again, the property sector spruiking yet more property construction to try and prop up the construction sector. But construction should follow, not lead the economy, in my view. Or look at this from the ACTU, which has called for a $30 a week or 4% rise in the minimum wage. And they rejected any move to delay an increase. Delaying increases in the minimum wage will delay the recovery from the coronavirus and mean unnecessary hardship for millions of working people and their families, an ACTU spokesman said. Local businesses will rely on how much working people have available to spend in order to get back on their feet. If working people have real wage cuts, this will flow through to all local businesses and make the downturn even worse. Any proposal that results in this outcome is a bad proposal. Now, of course, each are talking their own book, alongside the real estate sector, which is why we suddenly saw the talk of a resurgence in buyers from China, when the latest data from the FIRB is showing precisely the opposite, as we discussed the other day. And Peter Switzer penned a piece covering Harry Dent, Robert Kiyosaki, and myself, all highlighting the risks to the economy, households, and investments. He said, "The price of being objective and trying to be balanced means that you have to learn to deal with doomsday merchants, who, I have to admit, occasionally get it right." That's why I prepared to interview Harry Dent this week, the author of numerous books, Tipping a Great Stock Market Slump, like the one we recently lived through, which I've tagged the coronavirus crash. And surprisingly, I copped a second dose of pessimism this week from the famous author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki, who also expects another serious leg down for financial markets. Like all participants in the economics and market debates, I afford everyone respect, and that's why I interviewed Martin North for my Switcher TV property program this week. Martin, the founder of Digital Finance Analytics, who once suggested on 960 Minutes a 40% fall in Aussie home prices was distinctly possible back in 2018, which ended up being more like 12%, thinks the current pandemic economic shutdowns will play havoc with home prices. That's three negative people to process when I think we have a decent chance to get out of this very serious economic mess without enduring a depression and house price smashing. Note, I lack the certainty of the more negative experts because economies, markets, governments and central banks can be surprisingly crafty at getting us out of serious financial jams. That said, policymakers may well be out of luck. After 35 years commenting on these subjects in the public media domain, I've learnt that positivity and optimism is actually a better bet than being negative and pessimistic. Of course, what Harry, Robert, and I are actually saying is also positive in this sense. You can prepare now for the future. And on the other side of the correction we are all seeing, it's an opportunity if you know where to look. And here is a clue. Next Sunday, the 24th of May, we'll be running a one-day e-seminar discussing just that. It's free, and you're welcome to sign up. Details are below, or go to harrydentlive.com. And before you ask, no, I'm not getting any commercial benefit from being involved with this, but believe this is now the time to prepare. And you can also watch my recent shows with both Harry on property, is now the time to get out of property, and with Robert, recession, depression, the winners and losers. A parliamentary committee has heard that industry superfund owned ME Bank told both the banking and corporate regulator it was planning to lower redraw amounts on some older mortgages, even though it did not inform customers ahead of the move. In his first public appearance since it was revealed that the bank changed redraw rules without warning customers, Chief Executive Jamie McPhee said around 8% of affected customers, or 1,795 people, have had their previous withdrawal limits either partially or fully reinstated. Affected customers had redraw facilities on their home loans reduced by an average of $70,000 each, which sparked a huge backlash on social media. A redraw facility allows customers to make extra repayments, which can be called on later by the customer and withdrawn from the mortgage account. After repeated questioning from Committee Chairman Tim Wilson and fellow Liberal MP Jason Falinski, the tight-lipped Mr. McPhee revealed the bank had informed both banking regulator APRA and corporate regulator ASIC about the redraw plans, and it was still in discussion with them. We informed APRA beforehand and obviously were in dialogue with APRA after this issue was implemented, he said. APRA had previously told the ABC it was looking into ME Bank's change to some redraw facilities, but did not disclose that the bank had warned it in advance of its plans. Ms. McPhee told the House of Representatives Economics Committee that 17% of home loan customers had their redraw amounts lowered because they were assessed as at risk of missing mortgage repayments. And he said the bank should have told customers before the change went ahead. We got the communication wrong, Mr. McPhee told the committee. It is important to add that after we made this adjustment, customers could still withdraw money, but capped at their original repayment schedule. The ME boss said that the bank moved quickly to right the wrong by telling customers their redraw limits would be restored and by setting up a dedicated customer hotline. He said that more than 90% of affected customers had so far not renegotiated their withdrawal amounts. And over in the US, the Fed lifted their balance sheet by 3.2% last week, up just a mere $212 billion to $6.93 trillion, another record. And the House Democrats on Friday approved a mammoth $3 trillion relief package, not that it will get through the Republicans in the Senate. The Fed continues to resist negative interest rates, despite future markets now starting to price in those negative interest rates ahead. So you might want to wonder why the Fed is taking such a different tack to, say, the ECB. Powell said the evidence on the effectiveness of negative rates is very mixed. There's research that says that they've been effective, and there's plenty of doubt, as he said. And looking at the economies of Europe and Japan, clearly NIRP has done nothing for the economy. So that's an unsettled area, I would call it, Powell said. The issue really is the concern over interrupting the intermediation process, what banks do, and reducing bank profitability, thereby reducing the availability of credit in the economy, he said. Now that's an important clue, bank profitability. While the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, of which Powell is chairman, is an agency of the US government, and Powell is a federal employee, the 12 regional Federal Reserve Boards, the all-powerful FRB of New York that does nearly all of the asset purchases and swaps, plus the FRBs of Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Richmond, Atlanta, Chicago, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Kansas City, Dallas, and San Francisco, are private corporations whose shareholders, wait for it, are the financial institutions in their districts. And this is a critical distinction between the Fed and NIRP-infested central banks, such as the ECB, the Bank of Japan, or the Swiss National Bank. None of them are owned by the banks. And so they couldn't care less about bank stock prices, as long as the banks themselves don't fall over. And bank stock indices for Europe and Japan have plunged to multi-decade lows. But the Fed instead is relying on the 13-3 facilities, the alphabet soup bailout programs, many of them via special purpose vehicles that the Fed sets up and lends to, and then they can do, frankly, whatever the Fed wants them to do, such as buying eligible junk bonds. The label refers to Section 13, Paragraph 3 of the Federal Reserve Act with the Dodd-Frank Acts to put some limits on it. And in fact, because of that other tool, forward guidance, while they've talked about buying all manner of bonds, including junk, they haven't done so far. We frankly have helped already, he said, through the announcement effect. Markets have readily loosened up and started to function much better than they were doing just a couple of months ago at the early part of the crisis when markets were not functioning well. So we see that. And that has enabled many companies to finance themselves now, and that's a good thing. And it may mean that we actually aren't needed. And back to zero rates policy, Powell said, I know that there are fans of the policy, but for now it's not something that we're considering. We think we have a good toolkit, and that's the one we'll be using, Powell concluded, with an eye on US bank stocks that have already been hit hard in anticipation of big losses, with the US banks index down 45% year to date. The last thing the bank needs is NIRP. But meanwhile, in the real economy, the toll of the virus pandemic on the US economy continues unabated, as another 3 million people filed for unemployment benefit, and official figures showed 40% of low-earning families had now lost a breadwinner. The latest figures from the Labour Department mean that more than 36 million people in the US have filed for benefits in the last 2 months. The rate of claim is slowing, but the record-breaking pace of layoffs has already pushed unemployment to levels unseen since the Great Depression of the 1930s. For comparison, just 188,264 unemployed claims were filed in the same week in 2019. But this week, the Department of Labor started releasing figures for those eligible to file for benefits under the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, the PUA, a federal unemployment scheme set up for the self-employed and gig workers like Uber drivers who had previously not been eligible to make claims. Some 841,900 people made claims under PUA for the week ending 9th of May. And in the week ending 9th of May, the advance figure for season-adjusted initial claims was 2.9 million, a decrease of 195,000 from the previous week's revised level. The previous week's level was revised up by 7,000 to 3.17 million. A four-week moving average is 3.6 million. The advanced seasonally adjusted insured unemployment rate was 15.7% for the week ending the 2nd of May. And that's an increase of 0.3 percentage points from the previous week's revised rate. The previous week's rate was revised down by 0.1% from 15.5% to 15.4%. And finally, on the ongoing debate surrounding the virus lockdowns, the New York Times looked at Sweden's outbreak, which has been far deadlier than those of its neighbours, but it's still better off than many countries that enforced strict lockdowns. By late March, nearly every country in Europe had closed schools and businesses, restricted travel, and ordered citizens to stay home. But one country stood out for its decision to stay open, Sweden. The country's moderate response to the virus outbreak has drawn praise from some American politicians who see Sweden as a potential model for the United States as it begins to reopen. We need to observe with an open mind what went on in Sweden, where the kids kept going to school, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, a Republican, said at a hearing on Tuesday. But while Sweden has avoided the devastating tolls of outbreaks in Italy, Spain and Britain, it's also seen an extraordinary increase in deaths. Mortality data shows in Stockholm, where the virus spread through migrant communities, more than twice the usual number of people died last month. That increase far surpasses the rise in deaths in American cities like Boston and Chicago and approaches the increase seen in Paris. Across Sweden, almost 30% more people died during the epidemic than is normal during this time of year, an increase similar to that of the United States and far higher than the small increases seen in its neighbouring countries. While Sweden is the largest country in Scandinavia, all have strong public health care systems and low health inequality across the population. It's not a very flattering comparison for Sweden, which is such a great public health system, said Andrew Nomar, a demographer at the University of California at Irvine. There's no reason Sweden should be doing worse than Norway, Denmark and Finland. No two countries are exactly the same, meaning comparisons are inexact. Luck, travel patterns and personal actions play a role, not just government policy. Swedish officials chose not to implement a national lockdown, trusting that people would do their part to stay safe. Schools, restaurants, gyms and bars remained open with social distancing rules enforced, while gatherings were restricted to 50 people. 2 months later, it has not been the worst case scenario many envisaged. COVID-19 deaths have disproportionately hit the elderly and those in nursing homes, as is the case in most countries, but hospitals have not been overwhelmed. As with the rest of the world, it will be months or even years before the full picture of mortality emerges. It's clear that mortality in Stockholm has been a lot higher than you would expect from a normal year, said Martin Kolk, a demographer at Stockholm University. But we will have to wait and see what happens. It's a very big difference if we continue to see excess mortality for 6 more months, or if it will be back to normal levels in a few weeks. The New York Times measured the impact of the pandemic in Sweden by comparing the total number of people who have died in recent months against the average over the past several years. The totals include deaths from COVID-19 as well as those from other causes, including people who could not be treated or decided not to seek treatment. While no measure is perfect, the increase in death offers the most complete picture of the pandemic's toll. Swedish public health officials have defended their strategy while acknowledging that the country has failed to protect the elderly. The goal is to limit the spread of the infection without having to lock everything down, they said. Once you get into a lockdown, it's difficult to get out of it. Sweden state epidemiologist Anders Tegnell said, how do you reopen when? Instead of imposing strict lockdowns, public health officials said that Swedes could be relied on to go out less and follow sanitation guidelines. That proved to be true, as a whole, Swedes visited restaurants, retail shops and other recreation spots almost as little as residents of neighbouring countries, according to Google mobility figures. But there is a reason to believe that Sweden's approach may not work as well elsewhere. Sweden's low density overall and high share of single-person households, factors it shares with its Scandinavian neighbours, sets it apart from other Western European countries. In Italy, the virus tore through multi-generational households, where it has easily spread from young people to their older relatives. And although Sweden is not a particularly young country in comparison to its Western European peers, it has a high life expectancy and low levels of chronic diseases like diabetes and obesity that makes the virus more lethal. Even without a full lockdown, Sweden's economy has not been unscathed. Preliminary evidence shows Sweden has suffered similar economic effects as its neighbours. The Swedish Central Bank projects the country's GDP will contract by 7 to 10% this year, an estimate on par with the rest of Europe. And the European Commission projects the EU economy will contract by around 7.5%. That could change, but the country's high death toll offers a warning. Demographers say Sweden will be judged at the finish line, Mr. Norman said, but it's a very high stakes risk and the consequences are people's lives. So standing back, the writing is indeed on the wall for those who want to see it, that locally and globally economies are going to struggle for some long time as the unemployment queues grow longer, even when unlocking areas of the economy. The social distancing will cramp the style of many service businesses. And we already know that around 1 in 10 small businesses have shuttered forever, judging by our latest surveys. We'll do a deeper dive on that later. But the hopes of a spring back to the time before COVID seems to me unlikely. We have to take the slow, long road towards recovery while still, of course, in the shadow of the virus. And that is not a comfortable place to be. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.